Good evening, one and oh, I know we're in March. The daffodils are starting to come up in the garden and it's raining. Yeah, snow's gone. We finally got rid of the snow here in Connecticut where I am, and it's raining, of course. What else will it be? Well, this my guest today, we've tried a couple of times to meet up, and one thing or another, we haven't managed it, but finally we are both here at the same time, which is going to be great. I am old in, well, when we were talking last week, we were talking about Star Trek and how, when Star Trek first came out, we had the captain's log and the communicators and the sliding doors and everything like that. And the fact it's all come to fruition. But I am old enough to go way back to, in fact, I think the first bit of like science fiction, and that was in the Eagle comic we used to have, and it was Dan Dare. I remember that with the Martians and that sort of thing. And then after that, we had puppets, Puppeteer, Fireball XL5, Captain Scarlet, Stingray, all the sort of, if you like, the sci-fi type stuff, but in puppets. In fact, I tell you, I am that old that I can vividly remember watching the first Doctor Who in black and white. That how far I go back. And of course, things have changed since then. We have Blake Seven, all sorts of stuff. We've had all sorts of science. But same with the actual books and how they've changed. I mean, you go back to the days of, I don't know, Isaac Asimov and David Eddings on the science fiction, science fantasy, Piers Anthony and stuff like that. And science fiction was something to look forward to, something to, it's going to improve life. Look what's going to happen. Look how things will get better. These days, it's all like pessimism. The sort of good time and the sort of development of stuff seems to have disappeared a bit. But as we've heard lately on a few shows, perhaps that what was sort of futuristic, well, we know it no longer is. As we heard last week with the sort of stem cells that can produce either male or female eggs or sperm, just on the same animal. Anyway. My guest today, he was raised, if you like, with the old type of, and he's a huge fan of the old type of science fiction. We'll find out a bit more about him first, but rather than go into it all now. So I better introduce him, haven't I? On the show today, I have the one and only Devon Erickson. Hi, Devon, how are you doing?
Oh, well, great. And thank you for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure, and yes, I can go back to the old style of science fiction when things were, this is going to be good, and the future is going to be good, and not, it's the end of the world as we know it, sort of thing, which everything seems to be these days.
Yeah, definitely. The way I write. It's sort of something that tends to happen is when you see certain industries decay or go off the tracks or whatever, you watch this for a certain amount of time and you grumble this for a certain amount of time, and then finally you sit down and you crack your knuckles and you stretch your shoulders out and you say, "Okay, fine, I'll do it myself."
Exactly, because you actually thought about writing when you were young,
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
and you got put off until you retired. I mean, that's a big
Oh
put off.
yeah. Yeah. Well, I wanted to see, my father worked on the Voyager program
Oh, okay.
at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So I spent my childhood kind of hanging around the JPL campus on occasion, and I went to all the Voyager spacecraft press conferences where the photos of the outer planets were coming back in real time.
Right, yeah.
And so I wasn't obviously the first to see these, but I was in the crowd that was the first to see them. And then afterwards, we would have prints of these photos hanging up on our walls at home.
Wow.
So, and at the same time, I was going to the library, before they all got made into homeless shelters,
Yes.
and and I was bringing home these huge stacks of classic science fiction books,
Yep.
Asimov and Niven and Zelazny and whatnot, and And I would read through these, and it always sort of between what NASA was doing, what JPL was doing, and what I read in these science fiction books, I had the sense that the future wasn't necessarily going to be paradise. There's always going to be problems, but that we were going to, as a species, develop new capabilities, and that we were going to maybe go out there sometime and see these things for ourselves.
Yep.
And that we were going to sort of, humanity was sort of going to get out of this gravity well we were born in and go and colonize other places and see other things and expand and grow and change. And, you know, somewhere along the way, something happened. And just what it was is a very deep rabbit hole to get into. But a lot of people started getting this sense that their society was in decline and the future was going to be bad and we were all going to nuke each other. And they started writing stories about fighting with spears in the post-apocalyptic wasteland.
That's what I was going to say. That's what it all is. Post-apocalyptic.
Over the last container of freeze-dried coffee.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had wanted to, again, with zombies.
Yeah. You've got to have zombies there.
Yeah, zombies somehow. And I had wanted to be a science fiction writer when I was a child, and then adults, as adults always do when children have ideas, said, "Oh, that's nice, dear, but that's a stupid dream. Maybe you should go do something else."
Yeah.
And, you know, to some extent, I listened, because when you're a child and you want to launch a career, you know, you need support and money from people who are actually adults.
Right.
So, you know, I went to college and I became an engineer. And, okay, this next best thing, I'm not going to write about the future, but hell, I'll help build it. And so I wrote a bunch of software for multiple decades and, you know, built some neat stuff and built some not so neat stuff sometimes. And finally, when I retired, I said, you know, I can do whatever I want now.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go to any more meetings. And, you know, I miss science fiction. I miss science fiction, and I haven't been able to read as much of it lately because it's all spears and post-apocalyptic wastelands and zombies and stories about, like, how climate change is going to make us all, you know, live in mud huts with solar panels on the roof. And this sort of thing. And I said, well, you know, I'm just going to sit down and I'm going to write the kind of story that I want to read in the kind of future that I envisioned when I was a child, maybe slightly different because the tech has moved on and we know more things about what the future might be like.
Exactly.
But I'm going to write that same kind of technology. I'm going to write it in that same story style, and maybe it will give somebody else the feeling that, you know, Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle gave me when I was 15 years old.
Right.
And it's been amazing to me just how much that resonates with people today, even people who aren't really old enough to have had that kind of introduction to classic science fiction.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like there's two different parts of science fiction. There's a sort of development, look for the, you know, how things improving. I mean, if you look at the last 200 years, a fraction, small fraction of Earth's life, and how much development has been there in not even 200, so say 100 years, you know, where it's, and it's getting quicker and quicker every day. You know, it's taking less and less to develop and stuff like that. And our, what's it, 5-10% of our brain we use or something like that. It's a lot of this stuff is just beyond our comprehension, and that's where the earlier science fiction stuff was, because it was stuff that we could in a way start to understand, but now it's everything's so quick and goes, you know, an idea for 5 minutes ago is out of date almost. It's that quick. When you finally sat, you know, obviously when you wanted to write, you finally said, I'm retired, I want to do this right. Your book, well, I was going to say trilogy, but we know it's not a trilogy now. It looks like it's going to be four books. Orbital Space Trilogy.
Yeah.
Is that an idea you'd had sort of in your mind for a while, or was it something that came to you and you thought, this is it, I'm going to push myself to write this?
Well, it really was something that sprung out of what I was seeing in current technology, and also just the desire to tell a good story, because the technology is not all that's going on. You know, there's this cast of characters, small cast of characters that I go very deep into. You know, boy meets girl, girl blackmails boy into going on an alien artifact heist, hijinks ensue. But I would like to actually disagree with something you said there. You were saying that technology was moving too fast for us to understand. And what I would say is that science fiction is always one of the ways that we have understood technology.
Oh, yes.
And so if you like think about the 20th century, if you think about every major invention of the 20th century, name three or four that did not first appear in science fiction before they were invented.
No, I totally agree with you. You know, that's what I was saying when we were talking last week about Star Trek and saying, yeah, you know, the stuff that was, you know, heck, you know, these sliding doors and, well, sliding doors are everywhere. Communicator, mobile phone, captain's log, tablet. And they're working on the transporter type systems. You know, we had somebody, I think a couple of years ago, talking about the development that they're sort of doing on that. And it was there, and it's now real.
Yeah. So the way I like to put it is that culture and fiction are upstream of technology and law. They affect the way that we think about things, and they affect the way we think about possibilities. And one important thing that science fiction does for us is that it helps us think about how we feel about and what we're going to do about future pieces of technology before they arrive. We can think about the implications of the transponder, the tricorder, whatever the Star Trek thing is, you know, decades before we have cell phones. It helps us to imagine these things.
Yes.
Except now we have this situation where it's mostly, you know, post-apocalyptic spears.
Yes.
And that doesn't really help us to prepare for the future.
Yep.
So I didn't write about, you know, post-apocalyptic, you know, cobbling together old engine parts.
Right.
I wrote about fusion drives, and I wrote about a realistic path
not that far
toward
off.
Human... Yep. Toward human level artificial intelligence.
Yep.
One of the three main characters, in fact, is a prototype artificial intelligence.
Okay.
And she has to come to terms with her place in the universe because she's one of the first of her kind.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I totally understand and you know, agree with you in what you're saying. You can see that when you the idea came up. Did you have the idea of the characters, or did the characters come along and introduce themselves? Because that's my view is that no matter how much we plan the thing down, these characters lead you down whatever path they want to. Did they do that with you?
Well, I think as a writer, You know, every character is little pieces of yourself.
Exactly. Yep.
Combined with little pieces of other people that you've met. And, you know, there's writers kind of sort ourselves into two types. We call ourselves sort of gardeners and architects. Mm-hmm. And the gardeners are the guys who throw a seed in the ground and they just kind of see what comes up.
Right.
They tend to write from the beginning to the end. And then architects are the guys who plan everything out and we have a vision and we make lots of notes and we make lots of outlines. And then we tend to write from general to specific.
Okay.
Now, I am very far on the architect scale of things.
Okay.
The whole series is planned out. In fact, I have already written the last scene of the final book.
Oh, wow.
So I know exactly how
it
ends.
You know where you're going.
Oh, yes, I know where I'm going. You know, some of the details about how I'm getting there are, you know, in the process of being fleshed out.
Right.
But I know where I'm going. But one of the things I find is that your big upfront plan, well, a plan is a list of things that won't happen. So you always are finding out things and revisiting the plan, and definitely your characters develop as you write them.
Right.
And you gain a clearer understanding of who they are and just what your subconscious wants to do.
Right.
And certainly my characters, they start out really not very fond of each other, and they kind of have to learn to get along before they can accomplish anything together. So there's a growth there.
The first book was Theft of Fire, award-winning, I might add.
Well, we've been nominated for the Prometheus
Award.
That's
still an award, as far as I'm concerned. That's still an award. Your nomination is an award, you know?
Yes, yes. I mean, we'll see about the final results.
Exactly,
I'm up against Salman Rushdie, so we'll see.
No trouble at all. I mean, you started, I know you said originally it was going to be a trilogy, and we were talking before, and it's now going to be four.
Uh-huh.
Is that because the story's fleshed out a bit, or you've worked out, I need to make a bit more of this, and perhaps we need to bring that in? What sort of expanded it?
Well, it's okay. So there's a very clearly defined beginning to the story, and there's a very clearly defined end, and there's a bunch of stuff that has to happen to get you from one to the other.
Right.
And, you know, I finished the first one relatively as planned, ended up being 154,000 words, which for those of you following along at home is about 500 pages.
Wow.
And then, okay, I know exactly what has to happen in the last one. And I know what has to happen between the two.
Right.
And if you're hearing noises in the background, the kitten is insisting on sitting on me right now.
That's normal. Listen,
cats will do that.
We've had all sorts. We've had people in restaurants. We've had people being pulled over by the police on the show. We even had somebody phone in that started growling like a werewolf.
Okay.
There's a lady in the book.
Nice to know I'm in good company.
This is the joy of live shows.
Maybe even for the first time in my life, the one of the less crazy ones on the show.
There you go. Yeah, well, carry on.
So anyway, I was like, okay, these whole things have to happen. As I'm writing this second book, I realize that if I want to do full justice to everything that has to happen and not make it feel like a summary like a suitcase that I've jumped up and down on the lid on to get it closed, then I'm going to have to give myself two books to do this.
Fair enough.
So the actual sequence of events didn't really change a whole bunch, except I had to do some surgery because you can't simply slice a book in half in the middle and call it two books.
Right.
It has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, an arc, some satisfying conclusion.
Right.
So I had to do some surgery there. But it wasn't that I discovered a whole bunch of new events that I had to include. It was just, this is going to take up a lot more words than I thought. You know?
Oh, yeah.
When somebody goes to and sets out to write their first novel, they all think, oh, God, how am I going to fill 100,000 words? That sounds like so many. And when you really start and you really get into telling the story and with the detail it deserves and the descriptions of all the little things going on and all the character development and all the hard science orbital physics where I'm doing all my spreadsheet calculations to get the insertion for the gravity slingshot around Neptune right. When you fit all that in, you find 100,000 words. The challenge is, how do I not make it 200,000?
It's a lot easier to that and sort of end up sort of having to prune it down really hard and lose half the story, but it looks cut, it doesn't flow.
Yeah. Well, what I said to myself was, okay, how long this is going to be is long enough to reach the end.
Good thinking.
We're not doing stuff in trade paperback in drugstores anymore. Mass market paperback. Mm-hmm. This is hardcovers and ebooks and trade paperbacks, Amazon print on demand.
Yeah.
So I can make it whatever size it needs to be, so long as it doesn't feel bloated.
Exactly. So, very dear, very true. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to say, the first book, right? The first book.
When you
finally had that copy in your hand.
Uh-huh.
But was that sort of an elation, or did you think, well, okay, I've got the one, now I've got to get that out there, and then I've still got the others and the rest of the story to do? Was it sort of a satisfaction, or was it thought, oh my goodness, now I've started, I've got to finish it all off?
Both. Because, you know, there's no feeling in the world like I produced this from my brain and it's good and people actually want to read it. But there's also something I call second mountain syndrome, because it's like you've been climbing the cliff and you're exhausted and your hands are torn and bloody and you haul yourself up over the summit, and at the top of the mountain is another mountain.
Yes. Yeah. Very good description. And that mountain
is called publication.
Yes.
And, you know, the industry in the 20th century used to really help people get their books out there. Mm. Now it feels like a positive impediment. And, you know, I talked to traditional publishers and we went back and forth and I queried publishing houses and editors and agents and all this kind of thing. And finally I said, you know, if I really want to execute my creative vision, if I really want this book to be exactly the way I saw it in my head, the way I think that it's going to be good, the way my manuscript is intended to be, I'm going to have to once again stretch my shoulders, crack my knuckles, say, okay,
that's
fine.
Yep.
I'll do it myself.
I can totally relate to that. I know with mine I did. Time's beating us. It's gone so quickly. It's been really enjoyable. What I'm going to do now, Devin, is to actually hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find more about you, where your book's available, and, of course, what the news is on the second one, Box of Trouble. So over to you.
Okay, well, the manuscript, which we have mentioned, the book, which we have mentioned several times now, is Theft of Fire by Devin Erickson. That is D-E-V-O-N-E-R-I-K-S-E-N. And You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on, we go through Ingram Spark. So there's a lot of different platforms. We're on Kobo. You can even order us in bookstores.
There you go.
Yeah, yep. We're actually in stock in a few bookstores.
Wow, that's
and
good.
Yes, that was a proud day. We've been nominated for a Prometheus Award.
Good.
We've received the Atomic Rockets Seal of Approval, which is an award for hard science fiction that gets the science right. And we've been endorsed by a few famous people, including, I don't know if you know who John Carmack is.
Name rings a vague bell. Yeah.
The creator of the video game Doom, he founded his software.
Yep.
Yes. He wrote it, he read it and gave us a recommendation on Twitter. And that made our sales take off for a couple of days.
That's great.
So, yes, I can also be found pontificating on Twitter on, you know, politics, economics, the structure of stories, anything that pops into my pill-crazed head. And, you know, that's been fun. A lot of our sales have been driven off Twitter. And I actually had a proud moment the other day. One of the publishing houses that thoroughly rejected me for committing the heinous sin of writing in first person.
Oh,
I now have more followers on Twitter than their entire publishing house. So
that's great.
A small, spiteful moment of satisfaction. But what this shows me is that this is the 21st century. Publish is a button on my screen. And by God, if you have a story to tell and people want to read it, you can do it yourself.
I totally agree.
You can succeed.
Yeah.
If you build it, they will come.
Exactly. I was going to say that. You took the words out of my mouth. Devin, it has been great chatting to you. Really good to hear the success and everything. Perhaps even when your next one comes out, your next book comes out, you'll come back and chat to us again.
Oh, yes. Yes, we're looking for either the last quarter of this year or the first quarter of the next year.
Well, as long as I'm still around, it'd be great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, I would love to. I would love to. It's been such fun. Thank you.
Well, there you go. My guest today, Devon Erickson, D-E-V-O-N, as in the county in England, and Erickson is the E-R-I-K-S-E-N. And we've been talking about, well, his series, but the one that's out so far is Theft of Fire. And we know that Box of Trouble might come out this year. And if we do, we'll get him back on the show for that. It's really interesting chatting to him. Well, that's it for now. I'll be back tomorrow with another guest. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget...